I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Tuesday was supposed to be the footloose and fancy dress-up day at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Within hours, it was a scene of carnage as a shooter using a military-style weapon opened fire on a classroom of children, killing 19 students and two teachers. The slaughter was so devastating that some of the youngsters could not be identified. In fact, some parents had to give their DNA to determine if there was a match. Just think of that. This was the worst mass shooting since Sandy Hook in Connecticut in 2012. There have been other mass school shootings in the intervening years, including in Parkland, Florida in 2018. President Biden spoke earlier this week about this uniquely American problem.
What struck me was these kinds of mass shootings rarely happen anywhere else in the world. Why? They have mental health problems. They have domestic disputes in other countries. They have people who are lost. But these kinds of mass shootings never happen with the kind of frequency they happen in America. Why? Why are we willing to live with this carnage? Why do we keep letting this happen? Where in God's name is our backbone to have the courage to deal with it and stand up to the lobbies? It's time to turn this pain into action for every parent, for every citizen in this country. We have to make it clear to every elected official in this country, it's time to act.
We asked Mark Fulman to join us. He's the author of Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. He's national affairs editor at Mother Jones, where he created a public database to track mass shootings after a movie theater massacre in Aurora, Colorado, and that was 10 years ago. Mark Fulman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And you have covered mass shootings now for a decade. I just need to get your response to what happened in Tuesday in Uvalde, Texas.
It's just devastating to see this happening yet again with young school children. I say that as a journalist who's deeply invested in this subject, but also as a father of two. And I grieve for the families in Texas, as I know all of America is right now. This is a horrible problem, and we need to do more to deal with it.
Well, and the president talked about we need to act, we need to do something, and I do want to get to that. But I do feel for myself, and I think for a lot of other people that I know, this sense of anger, frustration, a sense that nothing can be done, that this is our country, this is America, and nothing is going to change that. Can you speak to that, Mark?
Yes. Well, of course, I relate to that as much as anyone, having focused on this for so long. It's a difficult problem. It's a complex problem, but it's not an unsolvable problem. And of course, it begins with the vast quantity of firearms we have in our country that are very easy to access in many places. There are big questions with where that has been and where that's going. But there's a much bigger picture here that I came to see through my work on looking deeply into this subject and really with the fundamental question of what more is there? This can't be the only way that we think about this problem, because clearly we aren't making enough progress quickly enough. That policy battle that has gone on for decades will continue. But there are other ways that we need to be thinking about what we can throw at this problem to try to solve it.
Should we give up, though, on Republicans and Democrats coming together and fashioning some kind of policy that would prevent some of these mass murders?
I don't think so. But also it's important, I think, to acknowledge that that's, again, one part of the political picture. So, you know, we have some big myths about this issue of mass shootings. And one of them is this notion that nothing ever changes. That is very true if you look at Congress in terms of any kind of national legislation. But there's been an enormous amount of change at the state and local level in the past decade, since the year of Aurora and Sandy Hook that you were alluding to, where I began all of this work myself. And the issue there is that it's very patchwork, and it goes in both directions politically. So we have states with tighter gun laws and many states that have loosened them. in that period of time. So the national picture is very mixed, and we don't have any kind of cohesive policy. But there has been a lot of change. So I think it's wrong to resign ourselves to this idea that nothing ever changes, because many things have.
And I appreciate the fact that, at the state level there have been some changes. But I do remember after Sandy, the massacre in Sandy, there was a call for assault weapons ban, a call for criminal background checks, that apparently 90% of Americans were in favor of that. And yet Congress, speaking nationally, of course, didn't do anything.
Yes. Well, the political component of this is deeply frustrating for so many people. And I think there is a remarkable disconnect that you're pointing to that we don't see with a whole lot of issues in our country. Or perhaps this is one of the most extreme versions of that, where you have an overwhelmingly clear position in the across the public in terms of, in this case, wanting to improve, to strengthen gun regulations, at least in some specific ways, including background checks. There's also tremendous bipartisan support for what are known now as red flag laws, which is a policy to remove firearms through a civil procedure from people who are thought to be a danger to themselves or others through a court process to remove them. So there are tools in the legislative arena that have tremendous support, and yet we don't see the response at the political level. And that gap is quite stark.
And yet we still see more mass shootings, too.
That's right. Well, and I think, you know, I was very troubled again this week to see the blame, the simplistic blame on factors of this problem that really mislead the public, in my view, about what this is really all about. And I'm thinking foremost of the blame on mental illness. We heard a lot of that talk this week already from Governor Greg Abbott in Texas and others. And in a political sense, what's so problematic about that is that it's really being used, in my view, to distract from the reality of the problem, because it's a way of getting around the gun debate, to just say, oh, this is all about people who are insane and crazy, and treat it as if it's sort of an inexplicable phenomenon. But it's not. It can be explained. I've studied it for a long time. There's a whole field of work called behavioral threat assessment, which we'll talk about, the focus of the book, that looks at the process that leads up to these attacks. You know, it is just wrong. It is a myth that these come out of nowhere, that these are crazy people who are snapping. That's not what happens in any of these cases.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me just pause for a moment, because I think in a lot of people's thinking, it is inexplicable why someone would go to a school and murder, you know, with an assault weapon, murder, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. In the case of Sandy, these were kindergartners. So I think for a lot of people,
yes,
I think you got to be crazy to do something like that. But I understand what you're saying. Crazy, not psychotic, but obviously crazy, disturbed.
Right, right. This is challenging, because I think we do run into some limits of lay language to describe mental health problems. The general public, I think, construes this as people who are, you know, completely out of their minds, hearing voices, detached from reality. That's a way that we can explain something that seems so inexplicable, right? That is so unrelatable. How could a human being possibly do this, to commit this kind of horror? It's very hard to relate to. But if we stop there, we're not looking at the fundamental reality of the problem. There are actually, in many of these cases, a long period of time where there is a rational thinking process leading up to the attack. So while the act itself is totally insane and evil, that's an appropriate way to think about that. It doesn't explain the nature of it very well, I don't think. And so if we want to address the many factors that feed into this problem, we have to also look closely, or more closely, at the mental health components. No mass shooter is mentally healthy. These are people with very deep problems, but they're, in many cases, a lot of them are circumstantial and behavioral, and they may also have some diagnosable clinical disease in terms of mental health. But that, in most cases, is not a fundamental cause. That is not what causes people to go out and commit an attack like this.
In fact, you say people do not snap and then engage in some kind of mass shooting, that there is some kind of planning. The little bit that we're learning about the alleged shooter in Texas, was that he was apparently relentlessly bullied in school, was a bit of a loner. There was a change in his behavior a couple of years ago. There were conflicts at home. Sometimes police had to be called to the home because of some form of domestic violence, as I understand it, between his mother and him. Are these all sort of signs of a potential mass shooter?
Yes, in the sense that what this method seeks to do is look at warning signs that are developing in a person who is struggling, who may be in crisis, who lacks help, who lacks connection. You named a bunch of things that we've seen already come out in the reporting in this Texas case in terms of a history of violent conflict, aggression, problems at home, problems at school, some evidence reportedly of self-harm by the perpetrator. These are all important signals of a person who is spiraling into crisis. So no one thing is predictive of violence to come out of that. But clearly this is someone who is in need of help. And this happened over a long period of time, as it does in every case. It may not always be easy to see, but to the trained eye, to a group of collaborative experts working on a threat assessment team, there is a lot that they can do to see ideas about violence developing, planning, preparation, along with all of these signals of personal deterioration, suicidality, domestic conflict in a home, problems in a school. These things all matter. And that's really, as difficult and dark as that sounds, that is the good news here, because that is the opportunity for constructive intervention long before this person buys body armor, buys high-powered assault rifles and large-capacity magazines, surveils a school, goes in and does what he did.
We're almost up in a break here, but I'm thinking of the Buffalo shooter who did plan his attack on the supermarket. He did say, though, he kept this information from his parents. He said, I lied to my parents so they wouldn't know that I was collecting guns. And I was sort of planning this attack on this supermarket filled with people going about there every day.
Yes, and that comes up in plenty of cases, too, the efforts to deceive and manipulate, which, again, by the way, is also points to the, you know, rational thought process that goes on in a lot of these cases, that, you know, you have to have clear thinking to plan and be deceptive and manipulative. So they can be hard to detect. But in the case of the Buffalo attacker, you know, he had made threatening comments at his school the prior year to the point where he was taken into custody and given a mental health evaluation. Clearly, there were people around him who were very seriously concerned. And that's really points to what I'm talking about, the opportunity for more robust and informed intervention to get in the way of these attacks before they develop fully.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Mark Fulman. We are talking about what happened in Uvalde, Texas on Tuesday. He's got a book called Trigger Points, and it's subtitled Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about the epidemic of gun violence, of mass shootings in America. And again, he's got a book called Trigger Points. Mark, let me read a comment from Tiara, because I think it speaks to what your book is about and what some people are doing here. She says, see something, say something. We can prevent mass shootings if the people who know something wasn't right spoke up to counselors and authorities. The perpetrators have always left a note, a post, or some evidence. And those who saw it didn't tell anyone. We need to empower each other to speak up. Authorities need to believe us and keep us safe. And your book is really about this program. It's a threat assessment, looking at behavior, training people to be aware of what's going on, and then figure out how to intervene for people who might be at risk for this kind of violence. Speak to that if you could.
Yeah, that's right. The raising cultural and community awareness of the warning signs and of the possibility to reach out for help is an important part of the mission of this work. Threat assessment leaders seek to cultivate that in the schools where this is done, in the workplace settings, and in the broader communities. And it is very important. The analogy to see something, say something is a good one. That's essentially the concept here. Most of these cases, the ones that you'd never hear about in the public because they are successfully thwarted, that most of them begin with someone speaking up and reaching out for help. And it comes to the attention of a team that then brings to bear resources and expertise to deal with it. There are challenges there too, though. It's hard to speak up about a friend or a family member or a classmate who's causing fear, anxiety with disturbing behavior. Often, I think people are hesitant to do that. And that's an important challenge that this field faces and that we face as a broader society. People tend to think that, you know, it's going to be a punitive response, which really isn't the core focus of this work. It's intended to be constructive as much as possible. Often, there's no crime that's been committed. But that's the whole point. You're trying to prevent crime from being committed. You know, there's also, it can be very hard to understand the signals. In many of these cases, especially in school settings, peers tend to think that a classmate is joking or the would-be attacker will say they are just joking. That comes up in a lot of cases, too.
That happened in Buffalo with the Buffalo case.
That's right. And it happened at Oxford High School, too, in Michigan last fall. But again, it's one of many signals in the noise that the trained eye can see, and that we can all see in terms of our instincts, right? You always see in the reporting after these attacks that people around the perpetrator sensed something was wrong or saw something that was disturbing, but perhaps didn't speak out. So that is a crucial first link in so many of these cases.
Well, you have to pay attention, you have to care, and you have to be willing to intervene. And that's, you know, that's a huge responsibility.
Yes, it's asking a lot.
Yep.
One of the things that I find persuasive about this approach, this model of threat assessment, is that it is fundamentally community-based prevention. It is built on the idea that everyone has a stake in this. It's not just up to the school. It's not just up to the parents. It's not just up to local law enforcement agencies or many mental health agencies, social services. It's all of that together. And that may be what we need to take this on and be more effective, in addition to doing better on gun policies and our mental health care system. It's all of these things, in my view. This is an enormous and complex problem, and we have to treat it that way.
How much of this is a problem of young white men, if we're talking about mass shootings? And largely, I mean, the man in Texas had just turned 18 a month or two ago and had gone out and bought two assault rifles and a lot of ammunition. How much is that a problem of young white men who have grievance, who are lonely perhaps, who are filled with rage?
It's very significant. That describes a lot of mass shooters and individuals who also are involved in plots of this nature, but it's by no means exclusive to that. And this is a really important point too, of not leaning too far into oversimplifying what this is, or believing in the notion that we can predict who will do this based on their characteristics or lifestyle preferences or interests. There is no predictive character profile of a mass shooter. That is another big myth about this problem. It's not just young white men. There's a broad range of people who do this. And so, you know, again, what we really need to be thinking about is the behavioral process. That's what this work seeks to do, is to profile that process itself, to see the patterns of behavior and circumstances that anyone is capable of. That said, it is, you know, this is overwhelmingly a problem of men, but gender is not predictive. The vast majority of men would never do something like this, nor white men. So you make these checklists of mass shooters, they're unhelpful. And this field of work has learned over time that there's a different way forward, which is to look at the process of behavior and circumstances.
We've interviewed a number of people here in Philadelphia about the problem of urban gun violence and, you know, spent untold hours trying to figure that out. And one of the phrases that stays with me with some of the people that do this work with young people is that hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether that's also true with mass killings, that sort of at the base of it, you've got someone who is hurting and lashes out at, in this case, you know, a classroom full of 9 and 10-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds.
That's right. There is a lot of trauma in the histories of the people who commit these crimes. And of course, that is no justification for right. what happens, but it is a defining feature in many cases. And it's really interesting to look at the history of threat assessment, how this field was developed that I write about in the book, where, you know, you had mental health specialists and law enforcement agents they were beginning to collaborate with go into prisons and psychiatric institutions and do deep interviewing with perpetrators of horrific violent events, of assassins, people who tried to assassinate presidents, who killed celebrities, school shooters, and found a lot of that, that these were people who had very broken backgrounds, deep trauma that they had no means to resolve, and the sense that they really had no other option but to resort to brute violence. And that said a lot about the nature of the problem and what could send someone down this pathway over a long period of time.
Well, let me pick up on what President Biden said, which is that other countries have problems of domestic violence. I mean, you know, all countries are dealing with disaffected young people, let's put it that way, but they don't have mass shootings. And in some of these countries, when they do, they get rid of the guns, you know, they put in laws and they prevent this stuff from happening. This is a uniquely American problem because we don't do that.
Yes. Look, there is no denying the basic truth of this. We have a serious problem with firearms in our country.
Right.
There are an estimated 400 million of them. They're very easy to get. And then when this happens over and over again, there is an awful lot of dismissiveness in the political dogfight that it's about the guns. Well, of course it's about the guns. You don't have mass shootings without guns. But again, we have to go beyond that because, look, this is the reality that we live with in our country. And we can work to change it, but we know the history of that process, where it's been and where it may be going. It's very difficult territory to make, you know, broad, deep progress on nationally in our society. Therefore, we have to ask the other questions. And I think there are also some cultural and political factors that feed into this, too, that may be distinct from other societies that don't have this problem in the way that we do.
Such as?
Well, you know, in recent years in studying this problem, one thing I've come to believe is that our sense of deep resignation to this is unhelpful. And in some ways, I think it actually has begun to fuel the problem. And what I mean by that is that we know through reams of case evidence that mass shooters are very aware of the media narratives and the political narratives around mass shootings. They seek notoriety, but they also seek justification. What they see is justification and credibility for what they're doing. Because if you're a person who has decided that this is your only option and your only solution to your problems and despair and rage, then you want to know that it's a viable thing that you can do. And so when we are saying as a society, there's no way for us to ever stop this, we can't do anything, we're stuck, it validates that form of violence in a certain sense. And mass shooters pay attention to that. That's we can see it in the case evidence. And so I think that narrative we have about this problem has, in a way, become part of the problem itself.
Hmm. You and I were talking about something on learned helplessness, and it's a kind of condition where you get, you know, shocked over and over again. Let's say, you know, the news of yet another mass shooting and nothing happens. And over time, I think it's almost human nature to sort of give up and say, well, I guess I'm just going to stand here and get shocked by bad news about mass shootings.
Yes, it's very painful to face this over and over again. So how do we do that? And I want to acknowledge, too, that when we see something like what happened in Texas, children being murdered in mass like this, it's so devastating and painful that to express in commentary the kind of outrage at this notion that we don't do anything, that is highly relatable. We all feel that. But it, in a way, it misdirects us from what we need to do, in my view. We need to say, no, this is not acceptable. There's a lot more that we can be doing. And think about all the ways we can come at it and then go do it.
Let me play a clip, and this is from Tuesday night. Steve Kerr, the head coach of the NBA's Golden State Warriors, expressing his anger, his frustration at politicians' failure to address the problem of gun violence.
So I'm fed up. I've had enough. We're going to play the game tonight. But I want every person here, every person listening to this, to think about your own child or grandchild or mother or father or sister, brother. How would you feel if this happened to you today? We can't get numb to this. We can't sit here and just read about it and go, well, let's have a moment of silence. Yeah, go Dubs, you know. Come on, Mavs, let's go. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go play a basketball game. And 50 senators in Washington are going to hold us hostage. Do you realize that 90% of Americans, regardless of political party, want background check, universal background check? 90% of us, we are being held hostage by 50 senators in Washington who refuse to even put it to a vote, despite what we, the American people, want. They won't vote on it because they want to hold on to their own power. It's pathetic. I've had enough.
And again, Steve Kerr speaking on Tuesday night. And Mark, it's true. The House passed a bill. I don't know whether it would have prevented what happened in Tuesday in Texas, but it's sitting languishing in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah. Steve Kerr's comments were very compelling. Yeah. He articulated with poignancy and power what all of us have felt over and over. He's not the first person to do that, and that's part of the problem here. We need to feel that, and we need to feel motivated by that, but we can't stop with that. That's what he's saying, right? He's saying, right, Don't become numb to this, and we can't. And again, my view has become, studying this for a long time, that we have to contend with the reality of it better. We have to understand it better. We have to dispense with some of the big myths about it. And then we have to tell ourselves we can address this in myriad ways. And yes, the battle over guns in our country is vital. We need to make progress on it, still a lot of progress. There is an enormous disconnect, which Steve Kerr was also articulating well. And we need to fight that and fight for change. But we can't be resigned to this idea that nothing can be done or nothing will be done.
Let me read a comment from Lois, and she says, you're blaming everything on mental illness instead of on the ability to get an assault weapon at the age of 18 years, or at 18 years of age. I mean, you can't drink unless you're 21, at least legally in this country. Is that a problem if we raise the age for an assault weapon, for instance? Would that help?
I think any number of steps along those lines would help. It's basic logic, right? And you can look at the cases we've just experienced in Texas and in Buffalo, New York, two 18-year-old young men who got a hold of these kinds of weapons very easily and legally. That's a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, we can see that clearly. Changing that alone will not fix this problem, because it's much bigger than that.
Here's a comment from Greg. Aren't we asking too much of our schools to take this on? They're already underfunded and struggling to educate our kids, let alone now bear the burden of identifying and stopping future mass murders.
That's a great question, and it's one that I asked in exploring this work.
Right.
And I think an important answer, one that I found to be the persuasive from leaders in threat assessment, is that this method uses infrastructure that is largely already in place, especially in a school system. So it's a matter of getting the training to those people. A threat assessment team in a school system will include administrators, school counselors, and psychologists, people involved in school security. You know, the number one mission of a school system is to educate children, but of course, hand in hand with that is this protecting the safety and well-being of children, and that is work that a lot of people in the school system are already doing. So if they get the training to do this kind of prevention work and have some additional resources from the community, the idea is that the bar to entry is not particularly high in terms of resources or time. But yes, there is an important question there about what it takes to, you know, ask people in a school system to do this on top of everything else that they have to do. We know how strained and strapped they already are for resources. But again, it's not just a school problem, right? This is a community problem. So you have other community leaders involved, and you have the whole community involved in the sense of raising awareness and speaking up when there's concern.
You write about a number of, these are school students, but nonetheless, a number of young people who develop a relationship, and that relationship helps them over time. I mean, even beyond threat assessment, to have a mentor or a coach, you know, who sees something in you that you might not see in yourself, or a teacher that sees that a student is feeling really down that day, that having that conversation or having someone notice can go such a long way for a young person.
That's right. And I've heard the same thing from leaders at the FBI who do this work, who say that they've studied these and investigated these cases as deeply as anyone and see places along a pathway to violence where if one person had just stepped in to connect, it could have changed everything. I mean, that's an extraordinary perspective coming from the FBI, in right. my view. And historically, too, in the landmark research that came out after Columbine called the Safe School Initiative, leaders with the Department of Education and at the Secret Service, which was one of the pioneering agencies of this work, concluded that one of the most important things for schools to do was to create better connection. They actually recommended that ideally every single student in a school would have at least one adult or one person in a position of authority that they could connect with, that they could trust, and that if you could reach for that ideal, you could diminish this problem greatly. And think about also how that is similar to a lot of the community intervention work that happens with daily gun violence in cities, including there in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
That's right, these violence interrupter programs, same core principle.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Mark Fulman, again, author of a new book called Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. He's national affairs editor at Mother Jones Magazine, or I guess it's still just called Mother Jones. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times for more information about the show.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Mark Fulman about how to prevent future mass shootings. We're obviously talking about what happened in Uvalde, Texas on Tuesday, but of course that's just one of a number of mass shootings at schools. And there have been, of course, mass shootings in grocery stores and in churches and synagogues and mosques and Walmarts in this country as well. Let me read a couple of comments here. Then I do want to play something that happened in Texas yesterday. Here's a comment from Jim. The gun industry has learned that when crime increases, people buy more guns, so they exploit that fear in their advertising. A listener tweeted, the increase in severity and frequency of these mass shootings all goes back to SCOTUS, decision that allowed individuals to arm themselves like a Russian assault trooper. An email from Irene. One way to stop this catastrophe is to ban assault weapons. An email from Jennifer says, as an educator and grandparent, I know that parents, teachers, and counselors intervene regularly when there are red flags. Many mass shootings have definitely been prevented. And she wanted to know whether there's any data on this. And Mark, is there any data? It's hard to get data on something that has been prevented, correct?
That's right, because you're proving a negative or a counterfactual, right? How do you know you've prevented violence if violence doesn't occur? There's a good analogy that a leader in the field uses, likening it to the efforts to prevent heart disease. Cardiologists can't tell you how many heart attacks they prevented, but they do a lot through treatment to mitigate risk. And I think that's a pretty good comparison for what threat assessment seeks to do, because ultimately this is about early intervention in its ideal form, getting in the way of people developing violent thinking and going down the pathway to violence.
Let me just set up a short clip that we have. This happened yesterday, actually. Texas Democrat gubernatorial nominee Beto O'Rourke confronted Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott and other officials on Wednesday. This was during a press conference about the Robb Elementary School massacre. O'Rourke says, Governor Abbott, I have something to say. The time to stop the next shooting is right now, and you're doing nothing. I should add the two are facing off in the gubernatorial race in November, but let's just give it a quick listen.
And at this time, I will pass the mic to Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick.
Excuse me.
Sit down.
You're out of line and an embarrassment.
Hey. Sit down.
Don't play this stuff.
The next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing.
No, you need to get his ass out of here. This isn't the place to talk this over.
This is totally predictable. When you
sir, you're out of line. Sir, you're out of line. Sir, you're out of line.
And Mark, it goes on from there. What should we make of that, if anything?
Well, I think what Beto O'Rourke was doing was expressing the deep anger and frustration that we feel after a horrific event like this. And that's valid and important. You also, I think, hear in that conflict the polarized deadlock that we have politically over guns. And so, again, this points to the reality that we face. What else are we going to do about it is the question for me.
And is it the Republicans? Are they the problem?
Well, they certainly are at the core of the political problem, yes, because in terms of standing in the way of gun regulation and reform that the majority of the country wants, that, again, that incredible disconnect between the politics and what the public says it wants through what we have in public opinion polling now for three decades.
Here's an email from Claire. The media template in covering mass shootings is to delve into information about the shooter and to report on the shooter's motives. At this point, should we be exploring the reasoning of a person who has carried out the mass murder? Might the attention that the media gives the shooter and their ideas be part of the reason they act out, they carry out this act? And Mark, I don't disagree with that. It's, you know, trying to find that we need to understand, we need to inform people, we need to figure out how to prevent, you know, the next mass shooting, but nonetheless, there's always that danger that someone will take this information and turn it into a reason to do something. Although, as you say, these things are planned; they are not snap things that happen. But go ahead. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yes, this is another significant aspect of the problem that I have investigated and thought about and written about quite a bit. It's important. It reflects the complexity again. And in my view, this is an important balancing act that we in the media have to achieve, because there is significant and extensive evidence that mass shooters are seeking media attention, that they're very aware of it. It's commonly referred to as the copycat effect. They're looking to previous attackers for inspiration, for tactical ideas. So this all speaks to how we handle this material in our reporting. And yet we have to report on this. It's very strongly in the public interest, of course, because of the profound impact it has and because of the questions around what can we do to change it, to stop it. So I think it's very important that we don't sensationalize it. A big part of this is demystifying some of the things that I was talking about earlier. These aren't, you know, sinister, evil madmen who do this. That's a way that we used to see this treated a lot, with kind of tabloid style sensationalism, with photos and videos splashed all over the media just 10 years ago. A lot of that's changed for the better. But we still have to grapple with how much do we look at, how much detail of a perpetrator's history and behavior. There are ways of reporting on that that are informative, that raise cultural awareness, but that don't go as far as fueling inspiration that we know many of these perpetrators take from our media coverage.
Sure. Here's an email from Christopher. America can never let go of their guns. It's an immediate go-to solution rather than having a culture of reaching out for help. And what you're describing, Mark, is we have to figure out how to change that culture.
I think so, and the politics is so wrapped up in that, and so is the industry. I mean, the gun lobby and the gun companies have aggressively promoted themes of fear and masculinity and these kind of cultural constructs we have that I think are also unhelpful to mitigating the risk that we see in people who do this, particularly young men.
Well, and let me pick up on that. I have looked at gun magazines, and they do glorify these, you know, these assault weapons and all the camo and stuff that goes with it, and making it look like you too can be a warrior, you know, out in the world. And the kind of psychology associated with that for a certain kind of person, it seems to me, is really dangerous.
Well, and it's not just them. It's Republican politicians doing it too in their campaign ads. You know, they all go out and film themselves with rifles and say, I will be a fierce defender of the Second Amendment. And, you know, there's a very sort of like, you know, manly framing of it in the message. And so this is a political and cultural message that is used extensively by people whose interest is in keeping the status quo.
Here's a comment from Samantha. We need to be talking more about the NRA's role in all of this. They're meeting now in Texas. They are culpable in creating a gun culture and paranoia around any thoughtful regulation. They've convinced many Americans to believe falsely that any gun control laws are an infringement of the Second Amendment rights. And Mark, the NRA used to be a gun safety organization. Do you know about how to be a responsible gun owner? And look at them today. And isn't it just horrifyingly strange that after Columbine, they also were about to have, or they had their annual convention in Colorado, rather close to Columbine, and now in a couple of days they're going to have one in Texas.
Yeah, and this is entirely a story of money and political power, and it has been well documented in books, in news reporting, investigations. I remember gun culture when I was a kid. I grew up learning riflery at summer camp in the Midwest. I loved doing it. I remember distinctly the sense of responsibility that came with it and safety. That was the culture. That was once the culture of guns in the NRA, yeah, if you can believe it. But it changed so dramatically when money and political power took over.
Do you think video games, violent video games, you know, first-person shooter games, does that play any role in the kind of mass shooting that we're seeing in the U.S.?
This was a really interesting aspect of the problem to explore, too, because, as you know, that has been scapegoated for decades, most famously after Columbine, that violent video games or media, films, entertainment could cause people to do this. There is no scientific evidence to support that. It's just not true from that perspective. But yet, we do see a lot of this activity in cases of mass shooters and in threat cases. And so the question is, what's going on there? What's the correlation, if there is one? And what I learned through looking into that for the book was that there are a lot of cases where perpetrators, as they're getting close to an attack, they do become fixated on violent material, watching a violent film over and over, playing first-person shooter games. And there's some thinking in the field that this is a way of rehearsing psychologically for what they're about to do, to kind of get up the nerve to do what they're going to do. But there's no evidence of causation. It's not the thing that is causing them to have this idea and then go out and do it. But it may have value to prevention work in terms of being an additional warning behavior that's associated with a whole other array of problems developing in a person who is creating concern.
And what about the role of social media? We're learning that this shooter in Texas had left some really disturbing messages. I believe it was on Tuesday, so it was shortly before he carried out this massacre. But nonetheless, how important are those messages that we see on social media?
Yeah, I think this is similar territory, and it's highly relevant now in the digital age where everyone's using social media, that we do see these kinds of threatening communications typically late in the process of planning and preparation for an attack. The field of threat assessment has long understood threatening communications to be a part of the picture, but now we do see it more explicitly through social media. So it isn't that a post on social media is going to be predictive. Again, this is one among many elements. But in a case of concern, that kind of behavior would be very important because it is marking almost all of these cases now.
You write, deeper study of mass shooters through the 2010s revealed more about key areas of warning behavior, including domestic violence, misogyny, and identification with extremists. Expand on that for us.
Yes, this is a rising factor that is of concern to threat assessment experts. An increase in violent ideology, in violent misogyny, and also the convergence of these kinds of extremism. And I think that also speaks to the question about how digital media affects all this and creates impact, because a lot of this is happening in the online space. We see people becoming radicalized, like the Buffalo attacker. And we see a lot of individuals who are kind of spiraling deeper into despair and rage through isolation in the online world, and becoming disconnected from the material world. So these are important factors. And there is a lot of violent misogyny and political extremism in threat cases now, more than even just a few years ago, in terms of what I hear from leaders in the field.
I was reading and I was scrambling or looking for the source, but nonetheless, that gun deaths have replaced car accident deaths when it comes to the death of young people. And that's just such a chilling thing to consider. We're here in Philadelphia. We're dealing with a serious problem of individual, almost every day, gun violence, people being killed or injured because of people using guns to inflict harm on other people. And now that's replaced car accidents.
Yes, as of a few years ago, this has become the leading cause of death for children in the United States. It's an extraordinary reality that we live with.
So we have a couple minutes, Mark. I mean, I just sort of what are you looking for in order to say, okay, we cannot despair. We need to do something. This is the something we need to do, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, I think, again, it's important that we don't resign ourselves to this sense of helplessness. And, you know, in a moment like this, after what happened in Texas, we feel such outrage, rightfully so. But it needs to not stop at that. We need to understand the nature of this problem and of gun violence more broadly. I've done a lot of reporting on that, too, the kinds of daily violence that you see in your city all the time and many other American cities. Suicide is a very big problem. The 2/3 of gun deaths annually in our country are from suicide. So these are reasons why a focus on prevention work became of greater interest to me, because it speaks to all of these issues. If you are trying to intervene more on the front end of this, we spend so much time reacting to gun violence, you know, arming people, having more police in schools, active shooter drills, even setting aside the debate over regulation, we're so reactive in our societal response. And I think we need to do more to be proactive.
And by that, we're almost out of time. By that, you mean caring for each other. I mean, not to sound really corny here, but, you know, looking out for each other.
Right. And fundamentally, that's the truth of this. This is communities coming together to prevent bad things from happening that nobody wants to see happen. No matter where you fall politically on the spectrum, conservative, liberal, nobody wants to see school children massacred. Yeah. So let's work together to prevent it.
Well, Mark Fullman, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. I'm glad to talk with you.
Absolutely. And such a tragic thing to talk about, but such an important thing as well. And again, his book is called Trigger Points, subtitled Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. And he is an editor, managing editor at Mother Jones. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you for joining us.